From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We value you. We're so thankful for your support. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, March 20th is Palm Sunday for Christians. It's also the equinox, celebrated as Ostara and Mabon by Wiccans and pagans. Monday brings the Zoroastrian and Baha'i New Year. Hindus mark Holi and Buddhists celebrate Magha Puja Day on Wednesday. Thursday is the Jewish observance of Purim, as well as Hola Mahala for Sikhs. And the 25th is the Christian Good Friday, part of Holy Week leading up to Easter Sunday. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, oh, there are other stories. Even as Senator Marco Rubio became the latest GOP presidential candidate to drop out of the race, frontrunner Donald Trump seemed to threaten potential violence should the party not nominate him at its national convention. Also, a North Carolina pastor opened a Trump rally by calling for Democratic presidential candidate and secular Jew Bernie Sanders to, I'm quoting, meet Jesus. And the Kentucky State Senate voted to advance a version of increasingly prevalent legislation that codifies into law anti-gay discrimination on the basis of sincerely held religious beliefs. Similar bills are under consideration in a number of other states. But Georgia, oh Georgia, that state's legislature just passed an odious allegedly religious freedom bill just before the end of the session. Over 300 major companies have spoken out against the measure, which critics hope the governor will not sign. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's show.
As we all know, increasingly in this election cycle, as in the two prior elections, Muslims are the subjects of a heated debate, but seldom participants.
A comprehensive new report on Muslim American beliefs and experiences from the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding. I'll talk to Institute Research Director Dahlia Moggahead.
You know what they used to do to guys like that when they were in a place like this? They'd be carried out on a stretcher, folks.
An increasingly disturbing component of the Donald Trump presidential campaign has been the level of anger and now even of violence seen at the candidates' rallies. Gatherings in support of others running for the Oval Office have also not been free of headline-making events. Photojournalist Zach Roberts has been in the middle of many of these campaign events, and on this week's show, he'll tell us all about what it's been like. But first,
I've selected a nominee who is widely recognized not only as one of America's sharpest legal minds, but someone who brings to his work a spirit of decency, modesty, integrity, even-handedness, and excellence.
When President Obama announced his pick for the Supreme Court this week, the politics around the situation escalated to a fever pitch. We're incredibly fortunate to get a chance to spend a few minutes with Rabbi Dr. J. Michelson. He just happens to have spent time as a law clerk for Judge Garland. Jay, you've been all over television on this. Thanks so much for squeezing us in.
Absolutely, Wilton.
What do you remember that might suggest how he is likely to weather the incredibly political environment he has been thrown into?
Personally, he's a big boy. I think he can handle it. He's not a delicate flower. He knows fully what he's getting into, and I'm sure that he and the president and the president's advisors have had, you know, long meetings about this. You know, he's also a very level-headed guy. You know, this is not something that anybody would really want as a situation to go into. But look, I think he was being honest and truthful when he said this is the biggest honor of his life. It is an honor to be considered. And he's already entered the history books as somebody who deserves to be a Supreme Court justice, whether he actually will be one or not.
Personally, What do you remember about him?
People say a lot of nice things about judges and people in this kind of position at this time, but it really was true that I experienced him as having an extremely high level of integrity, really doing the law in a very serious way. He was not someone who was just on the surface of things. He really got into the details, which made our jobs harder, right? I mean, we were his clerks. You know, there were clerks who would write draft opinions, and the judge would just sign off on them. Judge Garland was never like that. He would write his own opinions, or at the very, you know, go in the memos very in a very detailed way.
Was there a moment, or maybe moments, when you saw him, you were with him, you were talking with him, and he said something or did something that made you think, okay, I know this guy now. This is what he's all about.
Well, it's funny, you know, I haven't told this particular story to anyone else. You know, he and I were working on, I was the clerk working on a very long civil rights related case. It had been, by very long, it had been dragging on for 30 years. And, you know, there were 20 some odd plaintiffs and all this complicated facts and stuff, and we're spending late at night going through all of these details. And, you know, it's a legal case. I mean, so it's just looking at the law in the case, and just out of nowhere, he kind of said, can you imagine what it was like, you know, doing the work these guys were doing, the sort of heavy construction work, you know, what that must have been like? And then, you know, to be told that there was a discrimination issue and just what that would have been like for them as people. And I just felt, you know, it was a really profound moment, something like 2 o'clock in the morning, where, you know, here we were in the middle of a very detailed legal procedural matter. It was not, you know, just some sort of general thing, but just humanizing at that moment was something that just really changed the way I saw not just him, but what it was to be a judge. And I don't know that, you know, that's not to say that impacted how he, you know, thought about the legal issues in that case. But just, you know, he said even yesterday that, you know, meeting victims of the Oklahoma City bombing, for example, and really hearing their stories, that's not something that as a prosecutor you really have to do, but it was something that he chose to do as leading that investigation.
In his speech on Wednesday, Merrick Garland began with words about his family and faith. How significant were those aspects to his work in the past, based on your observations?
My sense of his Jewishness is like a lot of mostly secular Jews in America, that this was, you know, the immigrant experience is something that had a profound impact on him, and the sense of ethics and social justice values that are in that kind of liberal Judaism in the 20th century that really shaped him. You know, I don't think he's not a particularly, at least in my experience, particularly religious person in the conventional sense. But you probably have met a lot of the type, you know, and as a rabbi, I certainly have, of folks who are maybe not religiously Jewish, but who are profoundly moved, I think, by what people would call the prophetic tradition, you know, the ethical values that are in that tradition, as well as the Jewish experience of anti-Semitism and marginality. I thought it was really moving from a Jewish perspective that he shared, you know, his grandparents' story of leaving the Pale of Settlement. My grandparents also left the Pale of Settlement to escape anti-Semitism. And at that moment, you know, I think it was a really moving personal account that I think may actually open some minds and hearts, not necessarily of Republican senators, but of people saying, you know, ordinary folks saying, well, you know, this guy really should get a look. This guy deserves our attention, even despite all the politics. And I think that was a really powerful moment.
Jay, you've been speaking to the media a lot in the past couple of days. Do the questions you're getting asked about Merrick Garland and your time as his law clerk give you any insight into what the coverage of this nomination fight is likely to be like?
You know, I think it's an interesting challenge for those of us in the media to dance between realism and despair on this one. This should be a moment of celebration. You know, like the inauguration of a president, for example. You know, you see the constitutional system working. You know, you see checks and balances. The Senate, you know, the president nominates someone, the Senate vets them, and really, this should be a moment of pride for us as Americans. Mm-hmm. And instead, it really was kind of, for me, a moment of dread, because here's someone that I knew, you know, professionally, but also personally during this period of time, and you know, really feel like he's a good guy, and he's being dragged through a sham. Right. I mean, it's just ridiculous. We could get sidetracked into the issues of has this ever happened before? Short answer is that nothing like this has ever happened before. Mm-hmm. No filibuster, nothing can compare to this sham that we're seeing right now in the Senate that really degrades our democracy. And so it's this, for me, I think the coverage wants to be realistic. Obviously, we have to talk about the politics of this situation because it's so politically unusual. It's just unfortunate that this could be an opportunity to have a different kind of conversation about, here's this person as a centrist, what is his jurisprudence, how does he think about the law? You know, those are the questions that we could be asking if we actually had a real nomination process or confirmation process, rather than obviously the political considerations which are in the foreground.
What else, if anything, should our listeners understand both about this man and about the process that he faces?
I want to give you a dark horse answer to that. I wrote an article in The Forward, the Jewish newspaper, The Forward, about just one of the religious elements in this whole process. You know, these are senators who took an oath, right? They put their hands, most of them, on the Bible, and they swore to uphold the Constitution. The Constitution has, you know, the appointments clause that says the president shall appoint and the Senate shall provide its advice and consent. That's an oath, right? That was an oath taken in the name of God. And there's, you know, that's one of the Ten Commandments about, you know, not swearing a false oath, bearing false witness, right? And that, to me, is something missing from this story. A lot of the folks on the Republican side of the aisle profess a certain kind of religious piety, and yet think nothing of disregarding an oath that they took in God's name. I'd like to see more of that conversation. You know, I just saw recently one Republican said, well, advice and consent means refusing to even have a process. That's ridiculous. That's not what advice and consent means. Advice and consent means having a process. It means looking into the candidate and providing either consent or non-consent. You know, if Judge Garland is rejected on an up and down, up or down vote because a majority of senators don't think he's qualified to be a Supreme Court justice, all right, that's the process, right? But what we have now is an utter disregard for a constitutional duty that these senators swore to uphold. And I think as people of faith, that's something that we could be focusing on and that I haven't seen a lot of coverage of so far.
Dr. Jay Michelson wears at least two hats. He's a rabbi, meditation teacher, and leading writer on contemporary spirituality, whose latest book is The Gate of Tears, Sadness and the Spiritual Path. Jay is also a widely read columnist, as well as a longtime LGBT activist and leading expert of the religious exemptions movement. Jay is also an attorney who served as a law clerk to President Obama's nominee for the Supreme Court, Judge Merrick Garland. Jay, I honestly don't know how you do it, but I am so glad that you were gracious enough to include us in what you're doing on a very busy day. I thank you more than I can say for taking time once again to be on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure, and keep up the good work.
Whether in campaign speeches or daily life across the country, fear of and hostility toward American Muslims continue to plague a particular community within our society. What are the actual effects of that? A comprehensive look at the answer to that question is available now in the just-released report from the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding. It's titled The American Muslim Poll 2016. It's a great piece of research, and I'm very happy to welcome the Institute's research director, Dahya Mugahed, to State of Belief Radio. Dahya, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start with you. Just take a moment to tell us why the report and what you found out right at the top.
Why the report is because as an institution, we are dedicated to doing empirical, objective research on American Muslims, and we felt that there was no better time to get some evidence out into the public at a time of such emotional and polarized conversation. We are hearing so much about American Muslims and very little from them. And this is a way to help the public make informed decisions in this election cycle. Now, what did we find? We found that American Muslims are very similar to Americans of other faith communities. They lean democratic like Jews. They practice their faith very much like Protestants. And they are at least as likely as other faith communities to reject violence against civilians.
Is any of that surprising to you? And if it is, tell us. And if it's not, tell us what in the report really was surprising to you.
Well, none of that was surprising because it just reinforces what many other studies have found. So at Gallup, a similar question was asked a couple of years ago of Americans across faith communities and found the same thing. Muslim Americans were at least as likely, sometimes more likely, to say it was never justified to target and kill civilians. So that part was not a surprise. Where I was surprised was how optimistic Muslims remain despite the hostile rhetoric that is a regular piece of our media these days. They are, in fact, the most optimistic faith community we surveyed. We also looked at American Jews, Catholics, and Protestants, and Muslims were the most likely to say that they felt that their country was heading in the right direction. They're also the most likely to approve of the president. The other thing that I thought was quite surprising was how often American Muslims are reporting discrimination. The majority of Muslims in our poll said that they experienced some discrimination within the last year, and almost 20%, 18% said that they experienced discrimination regularly, and that was the highest of any faith community. The second highest being Jewish Americans at 5% saying that they experienced regular religious discrimination. Now, among this group, this regularly experiencing discrimination, the group that we expected to be very isolated, to want to pull back from the wider society, we found the opposite, that this group was more likely than other Muslims, actually, to work with other people in their community to solve problems. So while discrimination was linked to less optimism, not surprisingly, it was also linked to more activism.
You know, Dahlia, I want to get back to optimism in just a second, but do you have any sense of details related to the discrimination? In other words, is one region of the country likely to have more discrimination? Is the discrimination related to work, or is it related to community? Do you know about those matters?
No, unfortunately, we don't. As I've said many times, polling is a blunt instrument, and we only can really tell the outlines of a problem, usually, with a poll. Mm-hmm. And we have to do a different kind of research to get those details. What we do know is it was discrimination that they believed was targeting their religious identity.
Right. My guest is Dahlia Moggahed, Research Director at the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding, which has just released its American Muslim Poll 2016. Well, I have to tell you, because I know how smart you are, that I feel really good, because I think the thing that caught my attention first and most surprised me was the factor of optimism. And I've got to ask you, whether it's in the poll or whether it's just your own opinion, where does that optimism come from, and how is it being sustained in such a rhetoric-poisoned conversation in the nation?
Well, you know, I'll tell you, when I saw those numbers, I actually checked back to make sure we didn't make a mistake, that there wasn't some coding error, and said and found that, no, this was correct. And, in fact, two other polls over the past several years found the same thing, Muslims being very optimistic and very positive about the direction of the country under the Obama administration, frankly. Now, this was a very different story under the Bush administration, where Muslims were pessimistic, mm-hmm. very, very concerned about the direction of the country. So there was a dramatic change with the change in administration from the Bush administration to the Obama administration. So I do think that the popularity of the president does play a huge part in this optimism. I also think that those things are difficult, and people are experiencing discrimination. I still think that they believe that, you know, generally the country is moving in the right direction, that they believe in many of the policies of the president. His rhetoric is much more inclusive. And so that's I think, what's being reflected here. I also want to add one more thing, which I think was very interesting and may surprise many people, which was around American Muslim identity. And this may explain some of this optimism. American Muslims have a very strong American identity. They say, the vast majority, that being an American is an important part of how they think of themselves. And what was even perhaps more surprising is that Muslims with a strong religious identity actually were more likely, not less likely, to have a strong American identity. So they are connecting with their country and feel that, at least for now under this administration, it is moving in the right direction.
Hmm. Has the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding done enough of this kind of research in past years that you see other trends in the same direction, or that you find other contradictions from what it was in the past?
The Institute for Social Policy and Understanding has not done previous polls. I'm really comparing the polls of Gallup and Pew over mm-hmm. the years in looking at optimism from one administration to another. So it would be difficult for me to comment on the changes in Muslim attitudes mm-hmm. In other factors and other variables.
Well, Dahlia, this may be just your opinion rather than the documentation of the poll, but what is it in Islam that gives Muslims in the United States that kind of sense of optimism and positive identification in a nation where there is a lot of controversy about whether or not Muslims even ought to be here?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I think that ultimately Muslims believe that matters of the world are in the hands of God, and their faith in God being a compassionate God, a merciful God, I think has to do with their optimism that ultimately things will turn out and things will be okay. I also think that there was a sense of re-enfranchisement when Obama was elected in 2008. He was the first president to mention Muslims by name in his inaugural address. Mm-hmm. People were feeling like they were invited back as citizens, where they had felt for so long that they were simply a pool of suspects. Mm-hmm. And the fear now, I think, among many people is, after these 8-9 months are over, they may be relegated back to this position of just being a pool of suspects. And that is a concern.
You know, Dahlia, the interest that I've had for a long time in religious freedom, and you and I both have been together sometimes in lengthy discussions about the way American Muslims understand or misunderstand religious freedom. Is there anything in the polling data or in other research that you've done to show where American Muslims are on religious freedom? Because the reason I'm asking it is because that becomes tremendously important in how they hear someone like candidate Trump saying that he would discriminate on the basis of religion.
Well, I think that the belief in a free America and an identification with American identity is testimony to people's belief that this is a place where they can practice their faith freely. Mm-hmm. It is interesting to note that Muslims are as likely as Protestants to frequent a religious service. Mm-hmm. And people who go to the mosque frequently are more likely than those who don't to be civically engaged. Hmm. They're more likely to vote, to be registered to vote, to plan to vote in this next election, more likely also to cooperate with people in their community to solve a problem. So not only do they believe in this idea of religious freedom, but they are living this idea. And the more that they exercise their freedom to practice, it seems the more they bought into the democratic process.
You know, Dahlia, I think I'm about to ask you the most important question that I've asked you yet, and that is, what does the American public need to know about the findings of this research?
I think there are two things that are really important for the American public to know. One is that Muslim religiosity is in no way connected to radicalization, that it's quite the opposite, that mosques play a moderating role, and that Muslims are at least as likely as other people in America to reject violence, that there is no evidence whatsoever that they are prone to violence. And then finally, that Muslims are both patriotic and pious, and that there is no contradiction between these two identities.
I really do appreciate you getting it that succinctly, because every one of us knows, wherever we are on the political spectrum, that we've got to be more caring and more open and more inclusive with the Muslim community. I'd like for you, if you will, to take just a minute and talk about the work of the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding so that our listeners will have a grasp of what you are about, and also, if you will, tell our listeners how they can get on your website and learn from it.
The Institute for Social Policy and Understanding is a secular think tank that focuses on the social and public policy priorities of the American Muslim community. So we study American Muslims. And you can get on our website by simply going to ispu.org. And if you want to look at the poll, just same website, ispu.org/poll. And we encourage you to write in, give us feedback, ask us questions, and we're very interested in improving our research to meet the needs of the public.
Dahlia Moggahed is Research Director at the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding. The Institute has just released the American Muslim Poll 2016, which is available, as you've just heard, online at ispu.org. Dahlia, this report has received a lot of media attention, and justifiably so. You all did a terrific job on it, and I thank you for the research you're doing, and I also thank you for taking time to be with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, Welton.
A number of presidential candidates have made headlines with the number of supporters who've been gathering for their rallies. And in at least one candidate's case, with threatened and overt violence in some of those crowds. Covering a number of these events has been photojournalist Zach Roberts, who's with us to talk about what these events are really like. Zach, I'm glad you're going to do this. Welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Fantastic to be here.
You've been to a number of political events during this election season, specifically. Would you summarize briefly where you've been?
So I've covered New Hampshire. So I went to Trump, Rubio, Clinton, and Bernie rallies there. Went down to Ohio, covered one of the rallies right after the infamous Chicago rally in Cleveland, Ohio. Mm-hmm. Went down to CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, which is its own interesting little place. So I've been the past 2 months, the political season this year, it's been quite a lot of travel.
Now, my next question could be, have you seen your psychiatrist? But that's not the one I'm going to ask. Overall, how have these events made you feel about American democracy?
It's a mixed bag. I love the idea of people getting involved. The democracy when people are not interested worries me a lot, because then that means that people can kind of get away with stuff and, you know, whatever. But the last couple rallies I've been to, oh, man, it worries me. I mean, on one hand, you go to a Bernie rally, and people are really, really excited. They're excited about the idea of change. You talk to a lot of people, a lot of young people. I talked to 15- and 16-year-old, a bunch of 15- and 16-year-old kids who were at a Bernie rally, obviously couldn't even vote, but they were there. They knew the issues. They knew about Bernie. They weren't just, like, kind of on the let's go bandwagon, that's where the cool kids are going or something like that. They were there because they cared. And then on the flip side, I go to the Trump rally in Cleveland, and you talk to them, and wow, they're lightly informed about the issues. They think that everyone in the media is out to get them, is out to portray them badly, and like specifically out to misinform them about not only their candidate, but kind of what the issues that they care about. And then also, you know, I mean, you have the protesters there that I kind of feel a mixed bag about how they're protesting, because a lot of, like, it goes from screaming to then the next level above screaming, which isn't always in my years working as an activist decades ago, that to me that never really worked well. But the fact that it immediately everything, all the Trump supporters, not all of them, a lot of the Trump supporters, when they would go and talk to the protesters, and I put quotes around talk. I'm sure some of you guys have seen the videos around. I've got a bunch of my own videos that I'll be releasing soon, from straight from one of the rallies, and it goes straight to the kind of standard racial coded language. It goes from racial coded language to straight up calling. A African American protester was being brought out of one of the rallies, and you got a 60-year-old white guy yelling at him, calling him boy, get out of here, boy, like with all the kind of dripping 1960s, like the moment where I see this and I'm filming it and I go, wow, I've seen this footage before. I just remember it being in black and white. Huh. And then moving on to the kind of continual, like, get a job, get off welfare, never mind the fact the protesters are like, I have jobs. I actually have three jobs. Mm. Like, I can't get another job. The problem that we're arguing is the fact that you know, the economy's terrible. Mm. And it's amazing when you talk to them, because I've talked to a lot of Trump supporters, and you talk to some, you know, on the edge Bernie supporters, and the fact that they're actually, a lot of them are like, well, the only guy on the other side that I might see voting for is Trump, or the only other guy I might see voting for is Bernie. And you kind of, like, mm-hmm. if you know each their kind of their policies beyond, like, oh, populist outrage, you're like, oh, where are you coming from? It hurts the brain.
Yeah. Zach, let me ask you this. How different or how much the same have been your visits to other Republican candidates, not just Trump?
There, the Rubio rally that I went to, it's hard to say whether it was the kind of standard thing, but he, unfortunately, and I say unfortunately because he's one of the only ones that kind of at least attempted to take Trump to task a little bit, because he has no hope. I don't think he had any hope of pulling in Trump voters. Like, mm-hmm. I don't think any of those guys, any of the Trump supporters at the rallies were going to go and, like, okay, I'll go vote for Rubio. I think they were just going to go home and go back to their, go back to their lives. But the Rubio, I mean, that was one thing I was surprised. I've done a lot of, I also work as an investigative researcher, and I've done way too much work investigating into Marco Rubio due to his connections to a couple vulture fund operators. Mm-hmm. And he's super calm. he was really natural, funny. The crowd seemed kind of standardly interested. Like, I've been, you know, years and years ago, been to different rallies for other candidates, you know, and it seemed like kind of your standard political operation.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't badmouth or threaten the press like Donald Trump does, which was a nice thing. He didn't have people in the crowd turn around, look at, and yell at the press while we were filming the event, which was a nice thing, because Trump does that at every single event.
When we watch the news, does coverage of campaign events reflect the reality of what you've been seeing on the ground?
Kind of. But one of the problems they have is the way that for most of the rallies you have access. For everyone from Bernie to Clinton to whoever Cruz and Rubio, you had access. You can set up your tripod if you're a videographer, set it up to film, and then go talk to the crowd super easy, and even mingle in the crowd while he or she are speaking. With Trump, one of the big problems that I think that and he uses this. He uses it when, like, oh, look at, they won't show the crowds, they won't do whatever. Well, Trump puts you as far back in the room as he can, up on a stage, and everyone from the photographers to the print reporters to the videographers, the guys with the big, you know, shoulder cameras,
mm-hmm.
They're stuck all the way in the back in a place that we humorously and kind of darkly call it jail.
Mm-hmm.
Because once we get in there and once Trump starts speaking, we are not allowed out of it. Literally, security guards are posted at the one opening, and we cannot leave unless we are leaving, as in completely going out the door.
Zach, so what do Americans, against the backdrop of what you've just said, what do Americans need to understand about this process that they're just not learning from mainstream media?
It's a lot more complicated, that there's a lot of people, you know, I'll talk specifically because I guess, unfortunately, that's where the entire conversation is. A lot of people at the Trump rallies are, I talked to them for a piece that I'm writing right now about some of the supporters there, specifically women supporters there. And there are a lot of people who have never voted, haven't voted before. And I'm talking about, like, these people are like 60 years old and never voted before. Not like new voters, not like Bernie's new voters. And they're learning the political process in probably one of the oddest political elections that I can remember. I'm 34, but I've lived through a couple really weird ones. so it's unfortunately a learning process that most people get to have a couple elections kind of under their belt before they come across someone like Trump. So we like to say that everybody's, you know, like, it's like, oh, you know, they're Trump supporters are racist or they're sexist or they're whatever. And I don't think that they all are. They see a lot of what Trump says in maybe what their husband or their uncle, their grandfather says, and they don't attach that racism, that kind of general racism or sexism to Trump, because they attach it to how their father, how their grandfather or their brother or their sister or whoever was. Because you don't call, you know, it takes a lot to call a family member a racist or a sexist. Like, everybody kind of probably has that uncle, you know, at Thanksgiving that says those crazy things. And that uncle is just, oh, that's just crazy Uncle John or whatever. And they're not, but we don't attach to them racism. And I feel like since the media doesn't have the chance to ever have an actual conversation with these people, on both sides, they get portrayed as racist and media gets portrayed as, you know, as not portraying them correctly. And one of the problems with the 24-hour news media cycle, the way that MSNBC and Fox and everybody else does it, is that we can never have, you know, we either have these like weird panel shows where you pull in a bunch of Trump supporters and ask them to raise their hand if they think that Donald Trump is this or that, But you never actually have, like, 5-minute long conversation with like, better questions, really. That's one thing, too, is that, like, compared, you know, if you compare it to, you know, how, why don't you like Kasich versus why don't you like Trump, and kind of in-depth and interview people the way that you would theoretically interview someone in a debate. And I think that then maybe America in general could possibly see that there's a little bit, it's a little bit more complicated sure. than just straight out racism.
Yeah. I've got two questions I need you to answer rather okay. succinctly. One is, have you at any of these events, have you felt fear, felt afraid? And secondly, connected to that, what is the most memorable experience you've had in covering this these campaigns?
Okay. Fear, yes. I've been to Ferguson. I've been to, in the middle, I've been beaten up by cops and trampled. But really, the last time I was in Cleveland, and I was dead in the middle of probably 150 screaming people back and forth, and the Trump supporters were screaming all the kind of the worst things you could think of outside of the N-word at a black and white protesters on the other side. That I can say because I could see that in a moment it could have turned into something horrible. It could have turned into what you saw on the floor in Chicago, but 100 times worse because it was a much tighter crowd.
Most memorable experience.
Memorable. I would possibly say that was memorable, but I would say actually talking to the 15, 16-year-old Bernie supporters. And I was talking to them about how Clinton's surrogates talked about female Bernie supporters and their passionate response, and they had a response, and they knew what they were talking about. That was a moment that gave me just, like, right now I feel chills just even thinking about it, that, like, gave me hope for kind of the future.
Yeah. Zach Roberts is a photo video journalist whose work has been published in The Observer, The Guardian Online, TheNation.com, Al Jazeera America, Gawker, and Newsweek. He has brought his camera to Ferguson to Occupy Wall Street protests and to hotspots overseas. Zach, I really appreciate you coming on to do this. The stories are interesting. I wish we had longer to talk with you. Maybe we can do it again. Thank you so much for being on State of Belief Radio today. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. We all need to take a deep breath, I think. I do. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. Thank you. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, please share it with that person or persons. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. The community that has grown around State of Belief Radio is active all week long online, too. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussion. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
Preacher man, you see what he was.